Welcome to another episode of Behavioral Health Business Perspectives. I'm Ashley Hollowell, reporter with Behavioral Health Business, and I'll be your host today. AI is consistently introducing innovation, newness, and firsts to just about every job field. But simultaneously, the technology has introduced new problems, hesitancy, and uncertainty around what could happen to individual livelihoods if it can one day do their job better than they can. On March 18th, AI brought a new first to the behavioral health sector, the first union strike organized specifically over AI's use in care. Around 2,400 mental health therapists, social workers, and psychologists at Kaiser Permanente held a one-day unfair labor practice strike in response to concerns over Kaiser deploying new technology, which they feel could replace their work and diminish patient care standards. Union activity is fairly limited in behavioral health in general due to stigma around mental health care and the field's slower adoption of things like technology than other sectors. But the impact and reach of behavioral health unions is broadening, and it's worth paying attention to. Since negotiations can lead to large-scale strikes, unionization is often a touchy subject, and even more so in a field where unions are currently few and far between. Behavioral health as a sector is effectively the new kid on the block when it comes to union activity. But until now, strikes in the field have typically been organized over concerns around pay and contracts. This is the first time a strike has been organized related to AI's impact on the field, and it's worth talking about. Today, I'm joined by Alana Marcucci-Morris, part of the National Union of Healthcare Workers bargaining team. Alana was directly involved in the bargaining process for the recent Kaiser mental health strikes brought on by concerns around AI and care. She'll speak to what frontline clinicians are seeing and feeling on the ground. Alana will be in conversation with Isamu Pont, the founder of the Behavioral Health Fix, who is also joining us today. Isamu was recruited into a community behavioral health center almost a decade ago, where he built its first analytics department and worked on some early natural language processing and AI models. His work touched access, billing, interoperability, clinical workflows, EHR implementations, staff, etc. Today, he leads his own behavioral health strategy consultancy. Before the recording of the episode you're about to hear, I reached out to Kaiser Permanente for comment on the situation, and a Kaiser spokesperson shared the following response with me on March 27th for inclusion in the taping of this episode. Quote, "We remain at the bargaining table with NUHW in Northern California and are actively negotiating toward a new contract. NUHW is pushing a false narrative that we want to replace our care teams with AI. At Kaiser Permanente, AI does not replace human assessment and it does not make care decisions. Our care teams are always at the center of decision-making with our patients. Many AI tools have the potential to help our clinicians spend more time focused on serving our members and patients. Our proposals for the new NUHW contract are aimed at ensuring our members have timely access to high-quality mental health care, supporting our clinicians to deliver excellent care, and provide operational needs to meet patient demand. Our objective is to reach an agreement with NUHW that honors our clinicians and allows space for the potential of technology that can support them and help our members. To better address the growing need for mental health care, we are striving to make progress to improve access for our members and continue to optimize care. Our shared goal should always be to ensure patients get care that they need, when and where they need it. We continue to believe that through good faith bargaining and mutual respect, we can find solutions that benefit both employees and our members and the communities that we serve." With all that said, let's dive into today's conversation. Welcome, Alana and Isamu. Thank you so much for joining me today. First, because we're recording this before it's released, I should share with our listeners that today is Thursday, April 2nd, 2026, and by the time you hear this, some of the information may have evolved since our recording. Alana, with that, can you bring us up to speed on how things have changed since the March 18th strike to now and explain where AI is currently used and not used, as Kaiser has said, it's not replacing humans?
Got it. Yeah. So nothing has changed since our one-day strike on the 18th. Kaiser uses AI pretty freely in the form of documentation. It is more widely used in adult family medicine and medical settings. It is currently voluntary software for our behavioral health providers to use. And that's where it's widely used now. The murky parts that it might be used, but, you know, keep in mind, I'm a behavioral health professional and expert, not a tech guru. And so I do want to leave some of this wisdom to the experts. But from the lay patient perspective, the e-visits, which essentially is an app platform that allows patients to access all types of medical care through the health plan. In the last few years, they have expanded their use of e-visits in behavioral health, mental health, and addiction medicine. And so you go onto an app, you select that you're having a mental health complaint, you go through a series of questions that more or less are reflective of the GAD, which is an anxiety measure, the PHQ-9, which is a common depression tool, a few screening questions related to post-traumatic stress, and other common mental health symptoms. Those questions do not accurately capture psychosis. They do not always accurately capture a number of other mental health complaints. So there are, you know, gaps in what the questionnaires capture. And then after a series of both clinical and customer service type questions are asked through those screening questionnaires, the app spits out a treatment plan. Based on what you shared, we recommend, you know, this chat therapy program. We recommend this behavioral health class. We recommend that you actually schedule an appointment with a licensed professional in your local clinic because we couldn't figure it out through, you know, is it an algorithm? Is it automation? Is it artificial intelligence? It's murky, but from the patient perspective, it appears as if a robot just determined your care needs based on patient reporting only, which, you know, if you're in the industry, in the behavioral health industry, you know that half of what an assessment incorporates, half of what a licensed professional does when assessing a patient is their patient reporting. The other half is our own human observations. So it's some of that is missing through the e-visits. But those are the ways it's being used now. And then there's also the teleservice operators who more or less follow a similar script to what the e-visits offer. It's actually a lot shorter. You're not getting the full GAD or PHQ-9 in that. But the ways in which technology and perhaps artificial intelligence has affected our union and our workforce is that human licensed triage providers are no longer a guarantee if you are a Kaiser patient in California. So you're getting the app, you're getting an operator. There's these other ways that they access care. So in some ways, it already has replaced human licensed professional work.
And what is your view on the intersection of AI and behavioral health personally? Is there something that really has driven your personal viewpoint or stance on what you've seen so far at that intersection?
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic, right? Like, I really appreciate some of the technology that I can use when conducting assessments. We use a Lucet symptoms outcome questionnaire when we conduct initial assessments on the job. And when patients fill that out ahead of time, you know, I have a lot of information about their complaints ahead, and it does save that kind of time in the actual assessment. You know, but again, sort of like I suggested before, patient reporting is half of the work that I do. And sometimes, whether it's stigma, insight, shame, a good rational mind that can talk yourself out of your own distress, there's a lot of variation in these self reports, these patient-driven reports. So I, as the human being, take the other half of that assessment and do a little bit of fact-checking. It's like, well, you said this on the questionnaire, but I'm hearing you say this. Can you clarify a bit and find what seems to be most true based on my observation? So my position is that I am open to new technologies when they are used to assist, support, and strengthen the work that human licensed professionals do. I am cautious when we try to replace human empathy with robots. I don't think that healing can really occur when a robot tells you, you know, you're okay, you're a good person, despite all these, you know, things that have happened to you or things that you have done that you don't feel good about. Human empathy is the healing factor in direct behavioral care, behavioral health work. I think we'll lose that. You know, and I also know that our human anxiety is a tool that I use when I'm conducting risk assessments. That's the work that makes sure someone stays alive, right? If they're suicidal, homicidal, danger to others, or in a domestic violence arrangement, there's a lot of safety considerations that we have to take in mind. And when I notice a number of risk factors piling up, my human anxiety waves a flag that I can lean into that person and support them in staying alive so that they can get to their next appointment, so they can get to therapy and behavioral health care. So, you know, as a union and also just me personally, I am for technology when it includes human professional oversight.
And Isamu, what's shaped your view of AI's role in behavioral health, and what's your perspective?
It's a good question. So at the fundamental core, mental health is a human problem, right? We are a social species, and from my perspective, and I'm not of a clinical background, the relationship is part of the treatment. Like Alana mentioned, right, there's stigma behind this. So it's a practice of two-way human interaction that I think is a critical foundation of working with someone with these challenges. And when I think of AI in behavioral health, I think of it as this intersection of three big pieces. So one is AI helping us improve care outcomes. Layered on top of that is AI helping our staff better their capacity to treat, better their capacity to work, their own well-being, right? So there's this kind of bringing up the workforce. And I think the third is AI helping us just have smoother operations so that the underlying foundations is good. Alana, one of the things that I just shared that resonates is what you phrased as this anxiety meter that kind of goes up as there's this stacking of factors. That can only happen with experience, right? I'm sure you've had years of experience where you've built that ability. And I think AI can be tremendously helpful, but I think AI can also erode that capacity, that capability, if we don't have the opportunity to learn and practice and work with others. And now I'm back in behavioral health because we are still stuck with a lot of the problems that we were stuck with 10 years ago. And now we're just trying to randomly throw AI on top of it, hoping it will fix the underlying mess. And that's not quite how that works. So a lot of my work is with leaders and helping fix some of these things now.
Thank you both. And I'm going to be a really rigid podcast host for just a second and limit your response to this next question to one or two sentences. So Ilana, we'll go to you first. AI in behavioral health is currently most dangerous when it is used to, what would you say?
Replace human professional work. And also create ambiguity around accountability when malpractice happens, right? Because I'm a licensed provider with the state. If I commit malpractice or I don't properly risk screen or I don't do a good job, patients can complain to my licensing board and I would be under investigation and risk of losing my license for malpractice. What happens when AI gets it wrong. We hear about hallucinations. We hear about, you know, inaccuracies and rates at which it's misunderstood or it understands motivation in a way that is unsafe, like motivation to commit suicide. So that accountability is who is culpable? Is it the developers? Is it the health plan? Is it the provider who is told they have to review those notes but not given time in their schedule to do so? I think there's a lot of danger there.
And Isamu, AI and behavioral health is currently most dangerous when it's used to what, from your perspective?
When it's used as a replacement instead of support, when we're, it's such a scripted workflow that it narrows what staff can do and makes them implicitly trust the output of AI. I think that's a challenge. Black box tools that are touching care decisions without the level of scrutiny that humans go through in this space with licensure and all these other requirements. And over-reliance on these tools, right? So there's this idea of skill erosion, especially for younger generations who are coming in who don't have that experience to say whether they should trust this output or they shouldn't. I think those are very big, risky areas.
Good
point.
Now
I'm going to go to the other side of the coin. So what are some use cases you each do support AI's role or potential in within the mental health sector? Ilana, we'll start with you.
Oh, I may need Isamu's help with this one because I work for a health plan where there's just a lot of distrust. Now, if I wasn't worried about patient privacy in recording sessions, and I wasn't worried about what that data is being used to do, mainly replace me, I would be interested in using a bridge software and documentation software that meant I don't have to get back to my computer for what's colloquially known in the industry as pajama hour after you've went to pick up your kids, put dinner on the table, get them in bed, coming back to your computer to finish your clinical notes because there are real liabilities to patients when those are not done in a timely way. I would love that. I really would. Unfortunately, I don't have the trust that I need to put my patients' information at risk and also to supervise what AI spits out. So I'm still hesitant, I gotta be honest, but if there were ways that it would save me time and make my job easier without adding patients, because that's what my boss wants to do right now, is if I have less need for documentation time, then I have more time to be patient-facing. But again, I still have to supervise AI when it comes to documentation. So I'm not there yet.
Isamu, what would you say, where do you see the most benefit or potential for AI's use and support within the mental health sector from your vantage point?
Sure. So if we're talking about care outcomes, things like surfacing patterns in previous sessions, right? And how there's a lot of information in EHRs. So what if that information is relevant to a session that's coming up to work with a patient? I think that's a good use for how we're using existing data to help with care outcomes. If we're thinking staff well-being, I think scribing, Ilana, if we have all these risks managed, is a good use. But also, what can we do to learn so that we can be better at our jobs, right? So I think there's this enhancing the power of the supervision, your relationship with the manager, so maybe we are learning better areas that we can improve. Operations. So this was 8 years ago when I was like hand coding, like a natural language processing thing when I was working in behavioral health. And I didn't point it towards like case notes, right? I pointed it to IT tickets that were coming in because we had a new EHR implementation. So my code was running through it, categorizing the challenges different roles were having with EHR. And spitting that out back to our development team to say, hey, here are the things that aren't working. And to the training team to say, hey, here's where people are struggling. Can we have better training? So I think there are these use cases that aren't about getting in between the provider and the patient, but that can support that environment. And I think that's where we have the best use cases.
So, of course, the big question on everyone's minds and the impetus behind the Kaiser strike, could the industry reach a point where therapists or other behavioral health clinicians do lose roles to AI? And do you think we can expect to see more strikes like this ahead in the sector? Ilana, I want to start with your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's up to the big billionaires in charge, right? And also workers' readiness to hold the line. When workers are ready to hold the line in union environments, we can make a big difference. And so, you know, I'm not a fortune teller. So I do know that our one-day strike was very successful. We got a lot of people there. We had multiple union sympathy striking alongside because they too have a lot of unanswered questions around how AI could take their work away and destroy their livelihoods and cause other problems on the job. You know, this idea that it hasn't happened yet, I hear Kaiser saying they have no plans to do it. They haven't told you they haven't done it yet. So oftentimes you have to read through the lines because they have taken away clinical work from licensed triage providers and outsourced it or used teleservice reps or these e-visits, right? So technology is already replacing clinical work. We haven't gotten to psychotherapy yet, which is like the treatment phase and the phase that really requires even more human empathy and attention. But the screening role is very important too. I keep people alive when I am a triage provider. That anxiety piece I was talking about before. So yeah, I know that I've heard a lot of experts in the field, say that they really can't foresee this happening, and I want to really shake things up a bit and let the world know that it is already happening. To what degree will be up to the public, and up to all of us in what we're going to allow. Already very rich health plans do to streamline and make their bottom line bigger, make their labor costs smaller, and leave it up to AI, which again, who is accountable, right? It wasn't at Kaiser, but there was an eating disorder clinic in the last few months that as soon as the eating disorder therapists started to unionize, they just said, we don't need you. They fired them all. They replaced it with AI. All of their patients deteriorated, and now they are in a position to scramble to find human providers again. So the industry wants to replace us, and the big bosses that are ready to make a lot of money at the public's expense would do this now if the law and the public allows them.
Usama, what's your perspective there?
So I think the first piece is that AI doesn't magically become better at providing behavioral health services, right? It has to be specifically trained through data, through very specific efforts that take money to do the replacement. So I think currently we're seeing money flowing into that in terms of venture capital, private equity, to really just, that's the next problem to solve. So I think the intent there is to move in that direction, right? And I can speak in patterns. So if we look at the software industry, when we started being able to vibe code and all these coding tools came out, many software developers early on were like, this is great. It makes my job so much easier. And then we've had tens of thousands of people being laid off. They trained the software and then they got replaced, right? And as a result, there are systems that have gone down. There's been so much impact. And then organizations that have scrambled to hire people back on. So I think in a way, the world of technology is looking at behavioral health services as a technology, something that can be solved with the technology lens. I don't find that to be true. So what kind of resonates with me with what Ilana shared was that I think regulations are going to be key. I think raising awareness is going to be key, right? That the mental health issues that are going to be created as a result of social media and chatbots and relationships with chatbots isn't going to be fixed with more chatbots.
Right. That,
I don't see that as a feasible pathway. And I think more experts on the clinical side speaking out to why that human relationship needs to be there and regulations starting to mirror that is what's going to be important, because in a vacuum of regulations and this awareness is going to be filled by tech that might not necessarily help. And I think in terms of what happens when that tech company crumbles, right? What if their private equity fund dries out and that software just disintegrates? What happens to that provider organization that has added a tech capability as the critical way to operate? It's going to crumble if you don't have the foundations. And so I think there are a lot of different implications. I think the direction funding is looking to go towards seems to be in that way. And I think we need to add more perspective to that narrative.
Samu, much of your work also really focuses on redesigning operating models and systems from the inside out at behavioral health organizations. So from your perspective, if a therapist says their work feels like it's an assembly line with the addition of AI, or it's starting to feel like they're being replaced, what would you look for inside to diagnose and solve for that? What would you recommend to behavioral health executives around that?
At that point, it would be a fundamental question of what is your goal, right? Is your goal to be financially viable without any regards to the consequences, or is your goal quality care and outcomes for your patients? Now, if that organization says, we just want financial viability, there's no through line for me to do anything. But if they say that, actually, our mission is about taking care of our people and we want to be financially solvent, then the next step would be, okay, how is it helping or harming patient outcomes? How is it helping or harming your workforce? And that is the stacking of diagnoses that I would go through with them to see what applications make sense and what don't.
On the other side of the coin, Ilana, when you, from your perspective, hear language like AI as an assistant, not a replacement, and human-first technology or human-first care models, but we're adding AI, how does that land with a therapist like yourself or others in your network who are watching their documentation time cut and their visits being pushed back to back, potentially?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can have it both ways, right? Like, if we're going to supervise AI and we're already admitting that the workload of documentation is high and that therapists and providers are getting back to work during pajama hour after the kids are in bed and you're no longer on the clock, if we acknowledge that that is happening, then status quo schedule plus AI helping me cut 10 minutes here, 20 minutes there, minus the question mark around where that data is going and how that data is being used to train my replacement, you know, and minus the privacy piece and the hallucinations and getting it wrong and all these other parts. That's lovely. But if we're using AI to justify the reduction of time to get all my legal documentation done and these extra tasks, then we're not making improvements. We're just replacing one way that we used to deny and delay and erode care with a new way that we're denying, delaying, and erode care. I mean, burnout makes it really hard to be a therapist. I am providing emotional attunement, presence, space, slowing down to really listen in a world that is fast-paced and all about productivity and go, go, go. If you add 3 more patients to my already full day, those last couple patients at the end of the day are not getting a present me. So this idea that we would be 100% patient-facing, which is what I think my employer wants, and AI does the rest, still does not provide the quality healing care that premium pain patients deserve. So if my schedule was left alone and the time I need to document just transformed into the time I need to supervise AI, you know, again, minus the privacy issues, great, no problem. It's that it's being used in this way to justify takeaways and to increase burnout and to reduce my human capacity to remain present for patients that will harm the worker, it will harm the patients.
Isamu, I've seen some conversations you've been on in the past, not on this podcast, but other engagements you've been part of. And you've talked a little bit about AI scribes, AI front doors, AI for staffing, really kind of being process and automation problems in disguise, to my understanding. So how do you translate that thinking into guardrails for health systems, or how can they do that themselves?
I think it comes back to the intent piece in terms of what is the intent. So I'm giving a opening keynote in a behavioral health and AI summit next week. And this is one of the pieces that I talk about, is that in our current world, our use cases for AI shouldn't really be touching anything that comes around clinical decision-making. We're not there yet. There is so much operational drag in terms of having to sit in a waiting area and fill out the same form 5 times, right? There's so many other areas that need to be worked on before we even get close to touching the clinical aspects. Thank you, Lana.
I just wanted to say it's so nice to hear that. Yes, there's so many other ways and improvements that need. Like, why are we starting with the most precious and vulnerable?
My question for you, Isamu, was, you know, how can you translate that thinking, your viewpoint on AI, really being process and automation problems in disguise sometimes? How can health systems translate that viewpoint into guardrails, meaningful guardrails for health systems if they are going to use AI tools and they don't want their clinicians to feel this way?
Right. It's a good question. And I think the way we think about AI needs to be different. Currently, the discourse around AI is that it magically solves your problems. And that with most organizations I see, they're taking what's happening with vendors and what's being created and saying, ooh, that would be nice to have. But that's not speaking to the reality of what your organization needs. So one of the critical things that I do with organizations is talk about, okay, what is your biggest constraint in terms of driving better care, a better staff experience, smoother operations? And once you find out what your biggest problem is, then figuring out if AI is a solution to that problem versus saying, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could replace all of our therapists with AI? Cool, let's replace our CEO with another AI bot, right? Like, we go down that chain. Is the point to provide better care, or is the point to replace human bodies? And I think that simple guardrail is, okay, how are we bettering care? How are we creating our staff capacity and bolstering their well-being? And how are we making our operations smoother? Because, again, a lot of these tools that are coming out are venture capital-based. And venture capital pulls this money out real fast when there are no returns, right? So you install this critical capability that just disappears overnight. Would I want that as a leader in my organization? That is a major risk I would not want to touch. So those are some thinking guardrails I would have in place.
Thank you for sharing those. So this next question I want to ask both of you. With workforce shortages that are obviously very palpable across the behavioral health sector and expected to continue to be more pervasive over time, do you think that that factor makes AI potentially more tempting as a shortcut or a solution for large health systems? Or does it create pressure to actually invest in people? Ilana, what's your viewpoint on that?
I'm going to push back on the idea that there is a shortage of mental health providers in our industry. I mean, I live in California. I cannot throw a rock without hitting 5 MFTs. My position has always been, and my experience has always been, that there is a shortage of providers that are willing to accept factory assembly lines of the large health plans. You know, I work for Kaiser. I have friends who have came and went, right? I have friends that won't touch Kaiser with a 10-foot pole. And I'm talking about colleagues, you know, friends that are also behavioral health providers. Many of whom are in private practice where they get to manage their own time and the way that they implement care. Many of whom would appreciate the stability of working for a health plan because they do all the admin work, the billing, you know, everything that some of us really don't want to do, or would rather spend our time, you know, serving patients than all the administrative parts of the job that just don't, because they're protecting themselves from burnout. My private practice friends and providers can see between 5 or 6 patients a day, or Fridays, maybe only 2. Right? They are able to go to the grocery store, pick up their kids from school, have a level of work-life balance, and still pay the bills. When you work for a rigid health plan that says you need to do 7 assessments a day and gives you very little time to write the CPS report, do the documentation, collaborate with a physician or any collateral contacts if you're a child therapist, namely your parents and other caregivers, when we don't have time to do that quality work, it becomes very demoralizing and people leave. So, to me, you know, these health plans created a problem. They call it a shortage when really it's a shortage of people who can sustain these really, really difficult working conditions. And then they use that quote unquote shortage to justify replacing providers with AI. I mean, come on, you can't have it both ways. If there's a shortage, we should be preserving the human presence in the health plan and in behavioral health work. If there is not a shortage, why can't we retain and keep these workers? It, to me, you can't have it both ways. I don't buy the idea that there is a shortage. I just think that the standards of the industry are completely unreasonable.
Samu, how do you feel with you know, workforce shortages or talk of them across the behavioral health sector? Do you think that makes AI potentially more tempting as a shortcut or solution for some health systems, or create pressure in other ways?
I think that frustration stems from some of the things you were sharing, Ilana, in terms of there's a shortage because the pay is crappy, the work is full of friction, right? We talk about culture in our organizations and they're not... We still need to figure out what a good culture means, or the supportive culture means in practice. And those are much harder problems to solve, right? So Hence shortage, because if it's not an attractive industry, even if you care with all of your heart, which is what clinical providers usually have a lot of care in their hearts for the outcomes they want to drive, but everything else makes it really hard. So I think that we are in a vicious... It is a vicious cycle, right? If we say that there are shortages because we're creating those conditions just because it's harder to solve, and then we think, oh, technology will fill that gap. And so we're just running the cycle where we're further eroding the attractiveness or even the talent, the pipeline to really fill those positions. So to your question, I think, yes, tech industry does see it as here's a gap that we can fill with technology. And to the second part of your question, I think it should incentivize us to invest in people, right? Like I think that it should help us learn, and we can leverage AI to say, hey, here's how things are working and here are how things aren't working. How can I have a better employee experience? Guess what? AI will spit that out. AI will spit out what your culture of engagement could look like in tangible steps so your staff feel more engaged. It can help you create a pipeline, a pathway of learning for providers who are early in their career into more maturity. We can use AI in those ways to better our workforce and make it more attractive. I think we're taking the easy way. In some extent.
Ilana, one of the things that you've mentioned a couple of times that I want to dive into with you a little bit too is around the specific privacy or chilling effects that might worry clinicians around AI programs, recording therapy sessions. What are you hearing? What are you feeling yourself around those aspects, this issue?
Yeah, it's such a good question. You know, while I believe strongly that mental and behavioral health is health, right, that I believe in parity between physical care and behavioral health care, there are still unique differences, right? And what is discussed in a behavioral health appointment is not the same as what I would discuss with my physician. Now, I had a med appointment around like a rash on my arm recently, and the med assistant asked if my doctor could use AI to document the session, you know, and, you know, I'm less concerned about a recording around my itchy arm than I might be around vulnerable traumatic experiences in the past, experiences of sexual assault, experiences of violence in an intimate partner relationship, experiences of suicide attempts, of shameful things that you've done to other people that have eroded your conscience to the point of clinical depression that you need to get off your chest with a clinical provider because it has been eating you alive for years. These are shameful topics that the public doesn't enjoy sharing publicly. So the idea that we would record that creates a third party in the room that has a big question mark around it. You know, informed consent is a legal requirement of behavioral health. And so even if and when we increase the demand to use documentation software, it does not require patients to consent, right? The law is currently written that patients have to consent to their care and have to be informed of what to expect around their care. And recording, I think, is a pretty big piece that you'd have to be transparent about in order to meet the legal criteria of informed consent. So the nature of what we discuss is not my itchy arm. You know, I recognize there are medical things that are maybe shameful too, that would fit that argument, but, I don't think twice with my itchy arm, but I do think a lot of times, when it comes to these vulnerable discussions. So, you know, it's both where the data goes, it's the recording, but it's also what changes about the therapeutic relationship when there is an unknown witness there? I change how I speak when I'm being recorded. I think a little bit more and probably don't ramble on about more embarrassing factors of my life. The therapy session has to be free and safe for that to happen and for people to be just radically honest with their providers. And I think we will see patients changing what they bring to a therapy session if it becomes a performance or something that could be recorded and used against them later in some capacity. I mean, we're living in a very distrusting political environment. Lot of secrets, lot of shameful things are happening. And I won't get into that. That's not the nature of our discussion today, but that affects people's confidence in these systems and in technology. So until I have real concrete evidence that that is done ethically, that is done, you know, in ways that doesn't compromise the therapeutic rapport that is necessary for the healing work we do, why are we trying to fix something that isn't broken? Psychotherapy between human beings works.
So, Isamu, if a health system wants to use AI in these ways to learn from session transcripts, what minimum safeguards would you insist on, you know, maybe around informed consent, privacy, data governance, things like that, the ability to opt out without penalty? What's your viewpoint on that?
So from a research background and kind of like this tech lens, I would say that first, there should be friction to opt in, not to opt out, right? So the fact that you're being recorded shouldn't be a default because we're working with a more vulnerable population. So I think that's the first piece in terms of patient rights. I think second, unfortunately, almost anything can be hacked, right? So I would say that if anything that is being recorded can be offline, transcribed, destroyed within that session, and all that exists is whatever summary exists in your EHR, then sure, I think that is likely the safest way to implement that tool. I think that even the tech world is still grappling with what absolute security looks like with these tools, because it is a black box. We still haven't completely figured out how to govern these systems. I think just the other day I was reading how Anthropic, who has built Claude, like dumped Claude's entire source code into the internet on accident. And then in the process of retrieving it back, deleted like a whole host of other things off the internet. Right. So here are these really big, powerful tech companies that are still struggling with this security piece. I know that doesn't give you an answer, Ashley, but I think part of the problem here is that there is no clear answer. People can say that we've covered our butts with a policy or checklist, but the ultimate safety and security right now isn't guaranteed because we haven't figured it all out in the tech space. Yeah.
Right.
A lot remains to be seen. In closing, I want to ask both of you, what would a truly collaborative like AI governance process look like at large health systems? Who should have a seat at the table? What decisions should they be able to veto? How do unions and professional associations participate? And what does that role look like? We're obviously in a time when this is a tool that's not going to be put back into the box, so to speak. It's out there. It's in everything. It's infused into different tools more and more every day. So what does truly collaborative AI governance look like within health systems? Ilana, do you want to start?
Sure. You know, you have to include providers. You have to include the human licensed providers. And I'm not talking about the one psychologist who's in a startup and motivating a new software. I'm talking about a panel of consultation among providers to really make sure we're addressing all the safety considerations, all the privacy considerations, and all the potential negative impacts. The second thing that is a huge must is to get profit out of the motivation seat. Profit-motivated healthcare does have a strong incentive to reduce human labor costs and increase use of magic wand technology. So I see single-payer healthcare, Medicare for all, as the way that we get care back in the central mission statement, because right now profits are taking too far of a lead in terms of what is driving executives to make these haste decisions around technology.
Isama, what are your thoughts on that? Who should have a seat at the table in AI governance discussions?
To start off, I think decisions can't just be this like IT and legal and finance and vendor conversation, right? Because the incentives are just misaligned and it's not a complete picture. So agreeing with you, Ilana, in terms of we should have frontline clinicians and staff in the conversation, we should have clinical leadership in the conversation, ideally some patient voice, right, in the conversation in terms of
absolutely
does this help, does this not help? And I think there needs to be a mechanism in place to quickly say, hey, this thing is working for us, or actually is throwing too many potential red flags and we need to stop. So I think that sort of like shutdown cord should be explicit, because I think that matters in terms of how we move forward. But I think those are critical voices to have in the room.
Absolutely. And as you both mentioned, there's a lot that remains to be seen around AI and solving for these types of issues that we are not going to answer in today's conversation. But thank you, Ilana. Thank you, Isamu, for joining me today on this episode of Behavioral Health Business Perspectives. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us, Ilana. It was great getting to hear your
perspective.
Oh, yeah.
We got to reconnect, Isamu. Absolutely. Thank you, Ashley.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Behavioral Health Business Perspectives. I'm Ashley Hollowell with WTWH Media. Until next time.